Welcome back to the Magnolia Media Podcast, part of the Magnolia Media Network. I'm your host, Jonathan M. Ruggiero. Today, we begin our broadcast talking about the death of O.J. Simpson. Specifically talking about the O.J. Simpson saga, and believe me, it was a saga, of 1994 and 1995 through the eyes of a 10 and 11-year-old boy. 10, 11-year-old boy who grew up in rural, white, evangelical America. My grandfather framed my opinion on the world in so many ways, and it was he who really was not convinced that O.J. Simpson was responsible for the murders we now know he obviously committed. It's a shame that there was so much confusion around this topic at the time, because two innocent people lost their lives because of one controlling psychopath, that being Orenthal J. Simpson, or, as we called him in the day, the Juice, simply Juice. He had a million-dollar smile. He was the first running back of his style, or at least the first since Jim Brown in the 1960s. He was over 6 feet tall, broad-shouldered, long, 220 pounds, an incredible athlete, a Heisman Trophy winner. You had a long NFL career, especially for a running back, and then moved on to commercials for rental car companies, and of course the Leslie Nielsen movies Naked Gun, which are difficult to watch today, but they were entertaining to a 10 or 11-year-old boy. Even the slapstick style of comedy Leslie Nielsen is most famous for. My feelings about O.J. Simpson's death are not mixed, as O.J. Simpson was truly one of the great evil men of my lifetime. At age 10 or 11, I really didn't understand the gravity of what was going on. I was wholly impressed by his defense counsel, led by Johnny Cochran, Robert Shapiro, and Robert Kardashian. Yes, that Kardashian. So Kim is not the first person to completely sell out in order to make a little extra money, nor is she self-made, as her father was already a millionaire who lived in Brentwood, California, just down the street from O.J. Simpson's mansion, the one where he left the trail of blood all the way to the front door after nearly beheading the mother of his children. That's the shame in all of this. The first question that came to my mind when the news of the 76-year-old O.J. Simpson's death hit the airwaves yesterday was, could he have ever gotten away with such a blatant and obvious crime in today's world of social media? Would it have been a secret that the police had been to O.J. Simpson's house on 8 occasions due to domestic violence? A woman who had been beaten, strangled, had her hair pulled, been degraded, and cheated on. O.J. Simpson wasn't just an abuser and a murderer. He was also a groomer. He would send his handlers out into the crowds at universities where he would go to speak to pick out the girls that O.J. had seen in the crowd that he wanted to, you know, spend a little intimate time alone with. So not only was she living with all of that, she was also living under the powerful hands of a man twice her size, a man who slapped her around on a regular and obviously choked her at one point, as his handprint can be seen around her neck. But no one did anything. If anything, the attorneys that were close to the Simpson family came to the aid of O.J. when these things happened. But there was so much that played into that case, so much that we sometimes forget, including the legacy of racism that existed in the LAPD. Just 2 years earlier, in 1992, some passerby with a camcorder, yes, a camcorder, because back then we didn't carry high-quality cameras around in our pockets, happened to film a handful of white cops give a beating to a drunk black man named Rodney King. This, of course, led to riots in South Central Los Angeles. It became a very dangerous place in the days and weeks following what became known as the Rodney King beating. And of course, we all know the history of cops moving from cities with long racial histories like Boston, Chicago, Detroit, even New York, and Philadelphia, moving out to this new land known as Los Angeles, especially right after World War II when the first suburbs started to pop up in the greater Los Angeles area, making it one of the most heavily populated parts of North America and the second largest city in the country. That's the backdrop of what happened around the O.J. Simpson saga. O.J. Simpson had been spotted on several occasions outside of the condo, for which he was forced to pay by a court, so that Nicole would have somewhere decent to live. He was spotted out there in his Rolls Royce on multiple occasions. She even had to use the back entrance to her own condo to hide from this maniac. And just a few days before, she had her head essentially cut off, and so did the innocent bystander Goldman. This poor boy, who was an up-and-coming actor, who worked at a local restaurant that Nicole Brown frequented, had become an intimate friend. And they were minding their own business when the door was kicked in and the infamous Bruno Mollies, worn by O.J. Simpson that night, were tracked through the house as the blood was spewed everywhere. This was an awful man. And the Los Angeles media didn't do the world any favors by trying to cover for O.J. Simpson. Number one, when news broke about the death of Nicole Brown and Ronald Goldman, O.J. Simpson jumped in a white Ford Bronco and at gunpoint had one of his friends slash bodyguards slash whatever drive him toward Mexico with a gun to his head and via cell phone communicate with the hundreds of police officers in that infamous scene that, even if you weren't alive in 1994, is probably emblazoned into your memory. Of that white Ford Bronco making its way down the interstate as fast as it could, while all those Los Angeles Police Department squad cars chased them toward San Diego. Finally, the car did come to a stop, and O.J. Simpson was taken into custody and charged with a double homicide. Then the weeks and months, well, over a year that passed, a display of incredible negligence on the part of the judge in the case, on the part of the officers, the lives that were ruined, including that of Detective Mark Furman, for supposedly using the N-word at some point. This was sort of a backhand to the Los Angeles Police Department for its behavior towards African Americans for the previous 50 or 60 years, maybe longer. There was always a scapegoat on the other side of Crenshaw. This time, the black man wasn't from the other side of Crenshaw. He was from Brentwood. Again, neighbors with the Kardashians when Kim was a little girl, just a couple of years older than me. Somehow, he was found innocent. And we kind of know why. There was this theory at the time that it was just an attempt by a city like Los Angeles to bring a black man down, a black man who had reached a certain level of fame and wealth with which high society was uncomfortable. Well, let me pierce that Dick Gregory-style bubble for you and throw out just a few names. Tiger Woods, Michael Jordan, Magic Johnson, Hakeem Olajuwon, Shaquille O'Neal. Star after star after star. The difference? They didn't cut anyone's throat with a hunting knife purchased just a few days earlier. The amount of evidence against O.J. Simpson versus the amount of evidence allowed in court because of, well, crafty maneuvers by one of the lowest of low attorneys in the country, although he was one of the most expensive, and specialized in beating up on police departments and Johnny Cochran, was there as a mouthpiece for O.J. Simpson. Let's not forget that Robert Shapiro, Robert Kardashian, and Johnny Cochran also bled O.J. Simpson dry, which is a small price to pay for committing a double homicide. I do not remember O.J. Simpson fondly, despite at the time giving him the benefit of the doubt, because I was seeing this through the eyes of the adults in my family. And my grandfather, the man who raised me, didn't jump to racist conclusions. He grew up in a time and a place when race was, well, Jim Crow was in effect in Knoxville, Tennessee. But during the Great Depression, when there really wasn't time or space to be racist, he carried that a man is a man no matter what race, no matter what class from which he comes, all of his life, right up until his death in 2007. But when the O.J. Simpson saga was unfolding, he gave him the benefit of the doubt, despite the fact, running from the police in a car chase that was being broadcast on every network television channel in an era in which not everyone had cable. We were watching CBS, ABC, and NBC 24 hours a day, coverage of the O.J. Simpson trial. The Menendez brothers, I think they got in there just a little bit, but it was O.J., 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 O.J. As the assistant district attorney trying the case, really had no chance. As Judge Ito bent over backward, either in awe or in fear of the defense team that O.J. Simpson surrounded himself with. Judge Ito, Lance Ito, played as big a role in the exoneration and acquittal of O.J. Simpson as any single member of the jury, as the police department who made mistake after mistake after mistake in making sure that this monster was put away for the rest of his life. And perhaps Detective Furman used the N-word, because that was the bash against him at the time by Johnny Cochran and the rest of the high-dollar legal team for O.J. Simpson, a man once known simply as the Juice, with the million-dollar smile from the rent-a-car commercials and, of course, the Leslie Nielsen films, Naked Gun, as mentioned before. The man's life trajectory was in a J-curve. His NFL career had been great. His college career had been great. And now his acting and commercial career had been great. But his temper, his controlling behavior, and his outrageous temper finally got the best of him. When spying on his wife, he saw something, ex-wife, he didn't want to see, and took matters into his own hands, and damn near cut the heads off both Nicole Brown and her intimate friend, Ron Goldman, that night, that summer night, in 1994. The graphic nature of this crime cannot be understated. It was absolutely brutal, and only a man who had broken into an absolute rage and lost all sense of himself could have ever done this to the mother of his children. And of course, they played that up at trial too. Poor O.J. This happened to the mother of his children, a young son, a young daughter, left behind, motherless, made that way by their father. That was the simple fact that no one really wanted to swallow. Across the United States, there was support for O.J., no matter your class, your race. There was some soft spot that O.J. had created with that million-dollar smile and that historic football career. Those laughable commercials he was in. This was an evil man. And at 76 years old, before I go any further into how I saw things as a 10, 11-year-old boy, I was 11 in fifth grade when they rolled the AV carts into our classroom because they were about to read the O.J. Simpson verdict. Almost everyone expected it to be a not guilty verdict because if the glove doesn't fit, you must acquit. We're talking about a pure leather glove covered in blood stuck into an evidence bag and left there for over a year. and it still squeezed onto his hands. And of course they were fitted gloves. O.J. Simpson was a millionaire. Not to mention the handmade $3,500 Bruno Mali shoes. I mean, this was such a crime of passion and such a crime of blind rage by an absolutely evil man that he left a trail of blood right up to the front door of his Brentwood mansion. Stop and think about that for a moment. How much more evidence do you need? No matter your social status or how much money you have, you would be arrested and convicted in any court in the land with that type of evidence. You could say, well, Nicole's blood was in the house because of this or that. She used to live there. But what about Ron Goldman? What about Ron? When I think back about that case, the face that sticks out most to me isn't that shit-eating grin on the face of O.J. Simpson. Sorry, I just had to slip that one in there. It was the pain on the face of Mr. Goldman, Ron's father. Yeah, he had sort of a goofy mustache. But he was a father in pain who knew that his son would likely get no justice, who knew his son was secondary in this saga that was playing out. It was O.J. Simpson killed his wife, not O.J. Simpson killed his wife and her intimate friend. That was one of the many, many tragedies that occurred during this trial. The two children who would essentially be orphaned and raised by other family members. The parents of a young man who was working on an acting career and working at a local restaurant that was frequented by Miss Brown. That's how they apparently met and became close friends. I'll say this for O.J. Simpson, the juice, the Heisman Trophy winner, the movie star. If I believed in hell, even for just one day, I hope they reserved a spot for you. And I mean that from the bottom of my heart. And again, why run from the police with a gun to your head threatening suicide unless something was terribly wrong? This is not the behavior of a man who just found out that the mother of his children was essentially beheaded the night before. You might break down and cry, oh my God. Even if you despised her, even if it was a terrible breakup, even if you hadn't beat the hell out of her for years when you knew the police weren't going to do a damn thing about it, until finally a judge had nerve enough to say, no, you have to keep her up and a lifestyle to which she is accustomed, hence the condo in which she lived. Although she often had to use the back entrance to get in and out because O.J.'s Rolls Royce was often parked across the street, peering in. His claim was later he owned the condo, when that was straightened out again by a magistrate judge when, no, you paid for the condo. It's owned by Miss Brown. And after a decade of tolerating someone like O.J. Simpson, she deserved a little privacy. She deserved a little class. Yeah, it was a nice place. It wasn't a mansion in Brentwood, but it was just down the street so that O.J. could keep a close eye on her. And of course could walk home if need be, especially after committing a double homicide. I will never allow myself to have a fond memory of O.J. Simpson as he consumed almost 2 years of my childhood. You turn on the television, it's a replay of the white Bronco, the white Bronco, the white Bronco of O.J. with the gun to his head, the countless movies and documentaries made about this whole situation, about how the ADA in that particular case was steamrolled and her needs completely neglected by Judge Lance Ito, who had might as well had been a member of the defense counsel for O.J. Simpson. I don't know if he was enamored or in awe of or completely terrified of Johnny Cochran and Robert Shapiro, but he certainly took their side on almost every motion made in court. And watching this a little closer and going back and reading through it one more time, preparing for today's episode, Judge Ito, if he's still out there, you're a spineless little twerp who let a murderer go free. That is, until a man of immeasurable arrogance showed up to Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas, Nevada in 2008, Just a day before a sports memorabilia event was to take place at the convention center there at Caesar's Palace, where many of his items that were auctioned off once he was completely bankrupt after Johnny Cochran, Robert Shapiro, and Robert Kardashian had taken every penny he had to keep him out of prison, he was found guilty or liable in a civil court for the deaths of both Ronald Goldman and Nicole Brown in 1996. The families were allowed to go after every last penny he had left, including his Brentwood mansion and all of his sports memorabilia, including his Heisman Trophy, signed jerseys, and other similar memorabilia. It was in 2008 when, with two armed thugs, OJ decided to help himself through the lobby of Caesar's Palace up to the rooms to find the man who had acquired, legally acquired, some of OJ's personal sports memorabilia. OJ then had him pistol whipped, threatened at gunpoint, as he collected everything in the room that he wanted. Not just his things, he also stole some memorabilia of Pete Rose. And what the hell does Pete Rose have to do with O.J. Simpson? He played baseball, in case you forgot or don't know who Pete Rose was. He's perhaps the greatest baseball player of all time. Of course, blackballed from the sport for gambling, but it doesn't change the fact the man had over 4,000 hits in his career. And a couple of championships as a player, a couple of championships as a coach, all at the same team, the Cincinnati Reds. O.J. Simpson honestly thought that despite being caught on camera, despite it no longer being 1994, despite the advent of Facebook and Twitter, that he was going to get away with this. This is the kind of arrogant, smug SOB Orenthal J. Simpson was. The kind of man who would break into a hotel room on camera, have his bodyguard slash thug pistol whip a legitimate businessman, hold him at gunpoint while they robbed him blind. Well, it didn't go over so well. In fact, when he was hauled in front of the judge for this indiscretion, he was found guilty and she sentenced him to 32 years in prison. She gave him the maximum penalty on all counts. One doesn't have to wonder too hard or think about it too hard to figure why she laid down such a stiff penalty. However, in 2017, OJ was released from prison on one of the great cons of all time, where he found Jesus, apparently. And let us not forget that this is mostly a political commentary show. We're dedicating a little bit of this to one of the lowliest SOBs who ever lived, that one of his great defenders in the public media was the 45th president of the United States, Donald J. Trump, who despite all the evidence, who despite the fact he was a wife beater, despite the fact he may have been a rapist, despite the fact he was so arrogant they would walk through Caesar's Palace right past all of those cameras, go into someone's room and rob him blind. Keep in mind, these people who collect sports memorabilia on that level make a living that way and decide to rob him and just take whatever he wanted and then walk right back out on camera carrying it all. O.J. Simpson was nothing more and nothing less than an SOB of the highest order. And as I said before, if I believed in hell, I would hope he spends eternity there, where he belongs, alongside the tormented memories of the lives that he took and those that he destroyed. O.J. Simpson, dead at the age of 76. Now, on to politics. Donald Trump has got himself in a bit of a pickle. Big time pickle. The man who has taken credit time and time again for ending women's bodily autonomy in about half the states in the union, thanks to his appointment of three right-wing extremist activist judges to the Supreme Court, a man who has said that there needs to be punishment for the women who decide to have abortions. A man who wants to go even further than the Supreme Court and actually criminally punish the mother for having miscarriages has had to, well, moderate his position because of what's happened in recent elections. The elections like the case in the recent race in Birmingham, Alabama, a +7 Republican district that went 25 points. That's a 32-point swing for a Democrat after the IVF intervention by the Alabama State Supreme Court. If a man like Donald Trump were elected president and a Republican Congress and a Republican Senate ever had complete control of this country again, it would be modeled after, drumroll please, Alabama or Mississippi. They'd have the same economic policies and the same quality of life, which is something like 48th and 49th in the country, only outdone by Louisiana and Arkansas, which won't be outdone by anyone. They have to be at the bottom of the pile, the most violent states in which to live, the poorest states in which to live, the states with the most polluted air and most polluted water. Let's not forget that 79 cents of every tax dollar collected in this country comes from a blue district. You can call us elitist, call us whatever you want. The simple fact of the matter is, people who lean liberal, people who lean just a little to the left, keep America afloat, not these right-wing lunatics. And Donald Trump, well, he's kind of trying to straddle a barbed wire fence, and there's a barb sticking, you know, right in his, you know what. He's kind of stuck because there are true believers on the right who want to see abortion done away with, to want to see women's bodily autonomy erased from the books altogether, including Senator Lindsey Graham, who's now having a war of words with the former president, saying that Donald Trump needs to stand firm by his commitment to do away with abortion in the United States of America, while Donald Trump says he's not really committed to anything. He wants to leave it up to the states, but if it was up to him, a six-week ban's probably too much. Right after, half the states in the country passed a six-week ban because they thought that's what Trump wanted. This is tricky, Donald, tricky, because you can't afford to lose many of those evangelical votes. And by the way, if evangelicalism, if those people actually got control of the U.S. government and instituted religion, do you really think they would be friendly with priests and rabbis and imams? Of course not. Now, on to our favorite stooge in the House of Representatives, the hooved, however you pronounce it, Marjorie Taylor Greene, making Russian talking points on some fringe Bible network, saying that Russia isn't the country that's executing priests, that Ukrainians are doing it. And of course she would exercise her right to vacate the speakership if Mike Johnson brought funding for Ukraine to the floor of the House of Representatives. It would pass with flying colors, maybe with only 50 or 60 Republican votes, but Democrats would make sure it would pass to make sure that one of our allies isn't stomped out of existence by a country and a regime run by Vladimir Putin that only pretends to be Christian. By the way, they're Eastern Orthodox, so they don't even celebrate Christmas or New Year's on the same days as do we here in the West. And make no mistake that evangelicals are not fans of Christians. They certainly aren't fans of Jews. They don't mesh well with Catholics. Evangelicals don't play well with anyone. I grew up Southern Baptist, and I know firsthand that one of the things that repulsed the evangelicals I grew up around more than anything was the idea of praying the rosary or going to confession. Catholicism to them was as blasphemous as atheism. And Judaism, don't even get me started. So we would essentially be torn apart by sectarian violence the way Iraq was in the years after and just before the American invasion into a country in which we had no business. That's what we're staring at. So when Marjorie Taylor Greene cries about a priest being shot, an imaginary priest, and by the way, she presented no evidence whatsoever that the Ukrainians are executing priests, unless they're Russian spies. Let's keep that in mind. Let's keep in mind that little evangelical troll that clip-clops up and down the halls of Congress with her rotting gum line would be one of the first on the bandwagon to see Catholic priests be hung. This is the America that these white nationalists, aka white supremacists, want to see. And as far as people of Jewish faith go, what was the slogan chanted at Charlottesville in 2017? You remember the tiki torches? Jews will not replace us. Not my words, theirs. Jews will not replace them. Men who live in their mother's basements. I don't believe we have to worry too much about that at all. But, again, you give these extremists who were awoken by Donald Trump and his extremism, and as Trump tries to backpedal now, it's a little bit too late. Their hair is already on fire. And now you're not the goal. The complete collapse of democracy is the goal. The institution of religion and institutionalizing religion across the United States is their goal. Specifically, evangelical extreme Christianity. You know the one where Jesus carries an AK-47 and only gives money to the rich, makes sure that poor people starve. Remember that Jesus? Remember reading about him in the New Testament? Because I sure as hell don't. On to the next page. In MAGA land, a question for those of you who voted for Republicans after voting for Joe Biden. There are 13 districts in the House of Representatives occupied by Republicans that voted for the Democratic president in 2020 and then voted for Republican in 2022, hoping for more bipartisanship. When are you going to get it through your heads that bipartisanship doesn't exist anymore? The last piece of bipartisan legislation that we'll likely ever see was the Bipartisan Infrastructure Act. We might see something on internet privacy laws, but I seriously doubt it, as neither side, or especially the right wing, wants to give anyone a perceived win. So what have these people who were supposed to come in and cut inflation, these people who were supposed to come in and reduce the deficit, who, by the way, they're the same people who added $8.7 trillion to the deficit in just 4 years without a war because of an irresponsible tax cut that essentially cut billionaire taxes from roughly 15% to 8%. This is tax season. Look at the percent you paid in taxes. Joe American or Joanne American. What did you pay? 30%, 25%, 40%? Just a little FYI, Elon Musk paid 8.7%. And he's worth $200 billion. So this burden put on the U.S. economy, the deficit, which now outpaces our GDP. Our GDP, roughly $28 trillion a year, which is absolutely fantastic and blows everybody else out of the water. But our deficit, $33 trillion. Subtract 8.7 from 33. Without that $8.7 trillion deficit nightmare created by Donald Trump and his little Republican minions, and I'm including Mitt Romney and John McCain in this, much as we love John McCain and all he did for this country, he did vote for this ridiculous, stupid, and unfunded tax cut. See, if you want to cut taxes like this, that means you have to raise income somewhere else. Or you have to do away with entire programs. So when they tell you they're not after Social Security, they're not after Medicare, they're not after Medicaid, ignore them. This is absolute stupidity. And by the way, this week, the House passed a couple of resolutions. bills actually got passed through Congress without them having to have the proverbial gun put to their head. Let's see what they were. H.R. House Resolution 6192, quote, Hands Off Our Home Appliances Act. Really? H.R. 7637, the Refrigerator Freedom Act. Remember a year ago when we were having this discussion about gas stoves and how we liberals were going to come and take all your gas stoves away, but gas stoves, they cook so much better, gas stoves, and that sort of blew up in their face, no pun intended. Well, when's the last time you were in a Lowe's or a Home Depot? Were there any shortage of refrigerators? Refrigerators. And why do we need two bills protecting appliances? I mean, aren't refrigerators protected under the Hands Off Our Home Appliances Act? What sort of stupid do you have to be to vote for this? Where's the legislation that's supposed to reduce inflation? Oh, they didn't have to pass it because Joe Biden's administration cut inflation by 6% in one calendar year, from just over 9% to just over 3%, while wages grew at 5.4%, which means for the first time in a long time, wages outpaced inflation. Inflation is not always a bad thing. How about a bill to stop corporate price gouging? They could probably get some bipartisan help on that. That'd be nice, wouldn't it? Nope. In fact, if you even bring something like that to the floor, Marjorie Taylor Greene is going to exercise her right to throw the House into complete chaos again and get Speaker MAGA Mike Johnson fired. Speaking of MAGA Mike Johnson, where has he been lately? Well, old MAGA Mike, he's been down at Mar-a-Lardo, kissing the ring. That's right. He's been down at Mar-a-Lago conversing with a man we have to know he hates. He hates more than he hates anybody else in the world at the moment, and that is former President Donald Trump. Mike Johnson was forced to go down and kiss the ring and guarantee that he would be the MAGA speaker if Donald Trump were to be elected. Not that any of that would matter. The country would essentially end at that point. But he wants to have him 100% on his side after saying he's a humble man and that if you want to understand his political ethos, just pick up a Bible. That's MAGA Mike Johnson. Well, he just went and saw the least holy man in the world and spent some time with him at Mar-a-Lago, where he hides out awaiting trial on April 15th. That's right, April 15th, in Judge Merchan's courtroom and the Superior Court in New York City, Donald Trump finally facing criminal charges. Yeah, the hush money case, the hush money payments case, the fake corporations, all of the stuff Michael Cohen was smart enough to record, the perjury counts against Alan Weisselberg, who just got sent up to Rikers for another 5 months after spending 100 days there last year, for admitting that he committed perjury. He'll likely be the defense's only witness. This is a man who has twice been found guilty of perjury, admitting it the second time. That's who they're going to rely on, Alan Weisselberg. Well, I'm sure Alvin Bragg, the district attorney, will bring on forensic accountants, bring on people like Michael Cohen, who actually spent time in prison on Donald Trump's account over this very subject. This was about election tampering in the 2016 election. I'm actually very glad this case is happening and going first because someone needs to hold this SOB accountable for what he did in 2016, burying one awful story after another, using his friends at the tabloids like the New York Post to catch and kill stories, setting up corporation after corporation with Michael Cohen and Alan Weisselberg so that they could pay off prostitutes and porn stars, Playboy models, and take huge injections of cash from people like Russian oligarchs, just like the same Russian oligarch who just funded Trump Media, which, by the way, is collapsing. The last check was trading at about $30 after a high of $79, all of this in a span of 2 weeks. Absolutely insane. Well, as an American, as someone who loves this country, I hope that those of you who voted for Republicans in those 13 Biden won districts realize the error of your ways and bounce back to the other side so America can keep moving forward and protecting democracy, freedom, and bodily autonomy, and this raging fire that is the U.S. economy going. So we can pass laws to protect a woman's right. And oh, by the way, just a little side note, President Biden just closed the gun show loophole through executive order. Sure, it'll face backlash. It might be overturned by the Supreme Court, but the man had the balls to do it, to say you cannot sell guns at a gun show without an ATF license, without background checks, without running people's ID. The way it stands now, basically anyone can go into a gun show and leave with an AR-15 or leave with a shotgun, leave with a device of mass destruction without so much as an ID check to make sure you're old enough to buy it. Gun shows are some of the scariest places I have ever seen. And the thought that some of these people are here simply because they're felons or they have really bad intentions for these weapons that no one will even know they own. President Biden had the sheer will to step up and say, enough. If Congress won't do anything about it, I will. I hope that even if the Supreme Court strikes it down, the Department of Justice under President Biden's leadership continues to enforce this presidential resolution. That's my hope, because President Biden has been meek on a few other issues. Issues I would have liked to have seen him take a stronger stance against, like dissolving the Disinformation Bureau and the Department of Homeland Security and doing it quietly. Well, the politics of quiet don't accomplish much these days, President Biden. Dig your heels in and fight these SOBs every step of the way, because that's the type of president we'll need to get us through 2028, to get us past the madness of Mango Mussolini, to where it might be safe again in 40 or 50 years to vote for a Republican. As the way it is, it's not safe. It's not safe if it's Mitt Romney. It's not safe if it's James Lankford. It's just not safe. The pressure they'll feel from the far right wing of their party, which has more or less taken over the whole thing, will lead to book bannings, will lead to a complete ban on everything from birth control to abortion to the morning after pill. Methotrexone is already going in front of the Supreme Court this summer. So we'll see if the FDA has the ability to approve drugs or not. I mean, they've already stripped the EPA of just about all their rights, even though the EPA was created by Congress, and these Supreme Court justices are just radical maniacs. Hell, we give President Biden the Senate majority needed without Kyrsten Sinema, without Joe Manchin, who's going back to choke on all of his coal money in West Virginia. We might see an expansion of the court, a re-legitimizing of the court, if you will. Because they're not legitimate at this current moment. And we end today's episode with some exciting news for women. Women outperforming men on almost every major metric over the last decade, over the last two decades, to be honest. They've done it again, and they've done it in a way that I could have never foreseen. Monday night, the NCAA Men's National Championship basketball game took place between Purdue, a major university in Indiana, and UConn, a major legacy school in men's basketball, a historic team. They both took the court, and it was a tight game, an exciting game, until about the last 5 minutes when the University of Connecticut really started to run away with it. And they put Purdue out. Purdue got second place. UConn took home another national championship. 14 million people tuned in to watch that game. That's a lot. That's impressive. Very impressive. However, the Iowa Hawkeyes versus the South Carolina Gamecocks drew 18.9 million viewers a week earlier. 18.9 million. Why? One reason. Miss Caitlin Clark. Her second trip to the big dance in as many years. A woman who can score 30, 40, 50 points at will. A woman who made over $3.8 million in NIL money last year alone. Also, given her absolute dominance, despite the fact they lost, it's not an extremely strong team outside of Caitlin herself. She is going to be the number one overall pick in the WNBA draft that happens on April 15th. The same day the Trump trial begins. Isn't that fitting? Caitlin Clark has reshaped the way we look at women's basketball. It's more physical, and that goes for the men's game in college as well. It's more exciting. It's less about just firing up as many three-pointers as possible. There's nobody out there making $60 million a year, so frankly, there are fewer assholes. And it's a real competitive league. Now, 27 years ago, in 1997, when I was glued to the television like every other boy my age, waiting for Michael Jordan to make another appearance with the Chicago Bulls, it was announced that there would be a women's league launched. Unfortunately, 300 or 400 tickets per game were being sold. It was just a dozen teams or so, only in legacy cities like LA, New York, Houston. Although, Cheryl Swoops in Houston won the first two championships in WNBA history. Rebecca Lobo in New York. Lisa Leslie in Los Angeles. You know, we have to mention this because we do broadcast from Knoxville, Tennessee, sort of the home of the start of women's college basketball. The legacy of Pat Summitt, the seven national championships, the Women's Basketball Hall of Fame happens to be just down the road. And a surefire Hall of Famer, if she never picked up a basketball again, is Caitlin Clark. Caitlin Clark is one of the rare talents in men or women's sports that we will ever see. And the world notices. Up until just a couple of years ago, the maximum salary for a woman playing in the WNBA was $118,000 per year. These women being expected to live on that type of salary in places like Washington, D.C., New York City, Los Angeles, Seattle? No, they couldn't. Of course not. So they traveled around the world and played sometimes 10 or 11 months a year. Superstar Hall of Famers like Candace Parker have come out and spoken openly about it. Her husband plays in a French league. She plays in a Russian league, or at least did before the Brittany Griner episode. Brittany Griner, of course, spent 9 months in a Russian jail until a prisoner swap was made so that she could be freed instead of doing 10 years in a Russian prison for having a vape pen on her. And the fact she is a non-binary lesbian woman. All 6'9" of her. Brittany Griner, one of the most dominant women to ever play the game of basketball. However, women are not going to be able to compete on the interior against men. When 6'9 is the average size of a small forward in the NBA, But in the WNBA, 6'9 is about as tall as they get. However, guards in the NBA, Dame Lillard's about 6 feet tall. Steph Curry's about 6'2". Kyrie Irving's about 6'1". So why not an excellent ball handler like Caitlin Clark and a woman who can literally pull up as soon as she crosses half court and shoot threes all day at a good enough field goal percentage to allow her to shoot away. Again, who can go out and get you 30, 40, 50 points at will. Here's a little stat. If the first one about the men's game only getting 14 million viewers versus the women's game getting 18 million, here's a little stat that should help blow your mind. Have you ever heard of a thing called the Indiana Fever? I sure as hell hadn't. The Indiana Fever is an expansion team in the WNBA. Over the last two seasons, 2022 and 2023, they won 6 games out of 40 and 13 games out of 40, respectively. That means they are absolutely awful. However, last year, they got the number one overall pick in the draft, Aliyah Boston, from the University of South Carolina, a big inside player, a great rebounder, and a great post scorer. And they are absolutely, without a shadow of a doubt, going to draft Caitlin Clark. So, this team from Indiana, from Indianapolis, is going to draft Caitlin Clark. And what does this mean? What does this mean? It means that ABC, CBS, NBC, ESPN, and Amazon, yes, Amazon, are going to carry 35 of the 40 games played by the Indiana Fever in the 2024-2025 season. That's the impact one young lady has had on an entire league. The anticipation of seeing her play again after one exciting performance after another as an Iowa Hawkeye for 4 years has led over into the NBA. 35 out of 40 games will be nationally televised, including televised on Amazon, before any NBA game has ever been televised on Amazon. That's the impact of this young woman. So not only are there more women graduating from med school, more women graduating from law school, more women going to college and graduating in general, but now, women on a level playing field are outperforming men at games we created. And I say, round of applause. Hell of a job, Aliyah Boston. Hell of a job, Bayou Barbie. Hell of a job, Caitlin Clark. These women are doing something that the women who came before them could only have dreamt of doing. Candace Parker is running out of gas. She had to play 10, 11 months a year through most of her career to make a living. She's an instant first ballot Hall of Famer. She's going to be around to see this. She's already earning enough money to actually just play, you know, for one league and not have to travel around the world. Imagine if they cut LeBron James's salary so much that he had to, you know, go play in China and go play in Russia, go play in mainland Europe somewhere so that he could afford his lifestyle and to take care of his family. It would never happen. No, he'll get his $50 million a year no matter what, even at age 40, with the inability to make it up and down the court every time. But this young woman coming on the scene the way she has, we should take a moment and celebrate it. I mean, we just got out of Women's Month, and it has been an absolutely exceptional, exceptional tournament for women. I hope that a star comes along or replaces Caitlin Clark and is just as exciting to watch. I know I'll be tuning in to see her in the WNBA, and I hope that more and more eyeballs go to what is becoming to be completely honest, a more exciting game than the NBA version, the men's version of the game. It's more physical. The women seem to be tougher. And now you add a superstar, someone who can just pull up and pop a three on you from anywhere on the floor like Caitlin Clark, and you've really got something. All I can say is congratulations, women. Congratulations. Especially for all the women in the years past, like Cheryl Miller, who never got the opportunity to play professional women's basketball. And well, with that being said, that does it for us today. I want to thank Lady C for engineering and editing today's episode. I produced and directed today's episode. I'm your host, Jonathan M. Ruggiero. This is the Magnolia Media Podcast. Until next time, be well.